Welcome, Pacific Palisades, to the November 18th edition of the Pali Podcast, brought to you from right here at Village Studios on the west side of Los Angeles. It's great to be back in the studio. Today we have a guest that is remotely joining us, but he's at least in Pacific Palisades, so there's the connection. Steve and I are here in this wonderfully historic studio that we've always told you guys about, and we're dying to upload some pictures. So one of these days we'll have a big virtual party where we celebrate the historic place that we are lucky enough to be able to bring you this podcast from. So today we have Jonathan Zasloff. I will let Steve tell you a little bit about him, but I have a feeling he's going to be one of the more exciting conversations we've had in the last few months. In the meantime, how's it going, Steve Krohn, mid-pandemic?
Well, hanging in there. Things are, we're getting along, finding interesting things to do, and surviving like everybody else.
Any vacation plans for the holidays?
No.
Really?
Staying home. With the surge going on, I'm not sure where we would go.
Yep, there is a surge going on, not just here in the States, not even just in California or LA County. It's everywhere across the globe. Everybody. Yeah. I heard tomorrow New York City schools were going to close again. And across Europe, there's all sorts of quarantine notices in place. So, yeah, this isn't going anywhere for a while, although vaccines around the corner, possibly.
Maybe. A big corner.
A big corner. All right. Well, there was an election recently. We will bring you some commentary on that election, I'm sure. But today we have Jonathan Zasloff, who is a lecturer and a professor at UCLA. He teaches at UCLA Law School. He is also a rabbi, and he does so much more. Steve, take it away.
Hopefully good stuff.
Jonathan, so what have you been doing in your spare time besides getting PhDs and rabbinic degrees and things like that?
My spare time for the last few months, I've mostly been working on election stuff and teaching. You know, right. UCLA is, you know, all virtual, but, you know, I taught for a couple hours this morning, and we're doing everything we can to, you know, there's no way that the experience is going to be the same, but we're going to do everything we can to reach out to our students and make them feel as if they're getting as good of an experience as possible under these circumstances. I have to say, I think UC did the right thing. They just were not going to get stampeded into going back live and endangering the students, and I'm glad to be part of that.
Well, as you and I met for the first time, eyeball to eyeball, a few days ago, and found...
Socially distanced eyeball.
Yes, with masks on, but found that we have a lot in common. We're both lawyers. We both went to the same synagogue in the Valley when we were growing up, and we both teach law. And since I'm the lawyer, and okay. I tend to do a more, chronological... whatever lawyer-like approach to these things. I wanted to go back to the beginning, and then we'll come up to the present. And I know Miriam has lots of things that she wants to talk to you about because you have an incredible background. I mean, I don't know what degrees you'll be getting next, but I read your CV, and I don't think you've gotten anything in the last couple of years. So I'm sure you're working on it.
I should have a card that says Jonathan Zasloff, academic vagrant.
Absolutely.
And that would work pretty well.
Okay, so let's go back real briefly. Like I said, you grew up in the Valley.
Yeah.
Went to a .rel
temple. I did
about 12, 15 years before you. And then you went on to Yale undergrad and Yale Law School.
Yes.
How did you end up back there? Just because they were the top of the heap and that's where you needed to go?
I ended up back there because it's the way my college counselors recommended. I mean, really, I was fortunate enough to be able to get in. I don't know if I could have gotten in nowadays. It's gotten so much more competitive. But, you know, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. I didn't know from the East Coast. I had never been to New York City. I didn't know anything about it. My college counselor, Stuart Dunnan, now Father Stuart Dunnan, who's back in Maryland, really strongly encouraged me to apply to Ivy League places and thought Yale would be good. And I got in and I visited and I really liked it. And I wanted to see a different part of the country and a different part of the world. And I spent many years on the East Coast, you know, going to college and law school and grad school.
Yeah, most people would say college and then grad school or college and law school, but they wouldn't say college, law school, and then grad school.
I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, so I figured I'd do everything.
So did you go straight from college to law school?
No, I spent a year in England, and then I started doing my my PhD program. And the way that most PhD programs work is you do a couple of years of coursework, and then you take your generals, your orals, and then your ABD, all but dissertation. So I did my first years of graduate school, did that, and then I went to law school. I came back here, but essentially what happened is I started writing my dissertation doing papers in law school. And I was lucky enough that once I became a professor, you don't have to have a PhD to become a professor, to become a law professor. And so what I did is I wrote a whole bunch of stuff as a law professor, tied them all together, sent them to my dissertation advisor, and he said, looks like a dissertation to me. And so that's how it worked, I mean, which is the way that I had planned it, and it actually worked out that way. And I was very fortunate that it worked out that way. I do have a tendency to be somewhat of a dilettante. I want to do everything.
So you've got a bachelor's, a JD for law. You've got a master's in history and a PhD in what?
In history as well. American history, yeah.
So, Jonathan, I love that you say that you're the dilettante of the professors at the School of Law at UCLA, because you'll teach a little bit of everything. So I love that. I'm sure it's not a common trait with a whole lot of people, but I think it's great that you do.
It is. That's the old joke about a professor, somebody who knows more and more about less and less until he knows everything about nothing. And I try to shy away from that.
But I think that that's what makes you interesting. And honestly, when I look at the body of work that you have out there, that, you know, the things that you write about, it really is kind of impressive. I want to touch on all of them, but I think it might take us 4 hours. I'm going to take my green light from Steve, if he's going to let me jump around at this point. But
go ahead. You will, whether I let you or not.
Sure.
You guys can give each other, you know, visual signals. I can't, so.
Yep. You'll be in for all the surprises.
I'll do my best.
You said that in the last few months, you've been working on the election. And I know that you have your political opinions and that you're, you know, steeped in what's going on. But
right.
I wanted you to talk about a couple of things that I think have to do with politics. And I know that you are informed and, you know, have opinion about them. One is voter suppression. What's terrible about it? And the other one I want you to talk about, you wrote something, Federalism is for Suckers.
Okay, right.
You know, we're coming.
She did her homework.
Yes, my God.
Presumably, we're coming off of Donald Trump's term, but still, there's some damage that's going to remain. I just
tremendous
want
damage. Talk tremendous
a
damage.
A little bit about that. All right, so let's go with voter suppression. We just came off an election, crazy one though it was, nail biter. You know, still, you know, dwindling, but still arguments out there that there was voter fraud and maybe there was some suppression, and now it's a buzzword. Every side uses it. Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, you know, ever since. For the last 20 years, I mean, in my view, the Republican Party has been of the view that that they are going to try to restrict the franchise as much as possible through a whole series of devices. They can't do it in the same way that they used to do it in the Old South, but they're going to try to come close. You know, particularly when you have a sharply divided country. You don't have to suppress too much to win an election closely.
You don't have to do too much to make a difference.
You don't have to do too much to make a difference. And so there are a whole series of devices that they've used to try to suppress particularly the African-American vote and the low-income vote. When I was working in North Carolina a couple of years ago, it was an attempt to get voter IDs to prevent people from voting unless they had particular kinds of identification, which is more difficult for low-income or African-American people to get. That was struck down by their state Supreme Court. That all sorts of things. Texas is the worst, as it is in so many things. They made it very difficult to vote by mail. They made it very difficult in a lot of ways to vote. I mean, there was, to some extent, when you are so over the top about trying to suppress the vote, people get angry, and so come out even more. But in an election like we just had, you know, when it was at such a fever pitch, you know, we had a tremendous turnout. It didn't work quite as well. That being said, there are a whole lot of other devices that they will continue to use, not only in terms of things like voter ID and voter identification, but the other thing that is very, very disturbing now is the use of gerrymandering to essentially say, yeah, you can vote, but your vote isn't going to make a difference. It was really pioneered right after the 2010 census when Republicans took control of a lot of state legislators, and they drew district lines in such a way so that even if more people were voting for Democrats, Republicans would come up with the majority. The classic example of this was in Wisconsin, where in 2012, a majority of voters in the state of Wisconsin voted for Democrats, and the Republicans wound up with a supermajority in the legislature. And combining that with a series of decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court, particularly the most important one being one called Shelby County versus Holder, that basically stripped the Justice Department of the ability to stop states with a history of voter suppression from taking measures that continue to suppress the vote. In 1965, the Voting Rights Act was passed, and it had been the law for nearly 50 years. And suddenly, in 2013, it used to be that there was this method that the Justice Department could say to a state that was under stricter supervision because of segregation and because of previous racism, no, you can't change your rules like this in a way that would disenfranchise voters of color. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, said, oh, guess what? We don't need to bother with this anymore because the country has changed so much since 1965. We don't have to worry about it. And the late Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent, said, well, that's like, you know, using an umbrella when it's raining outside and then saying, oh, well, we don't need the umbrella anymore because it's perfectly dry under the umbrella. And that was particularly devastating in North Carolina, where I was. I'm literally within hours after that decision came down, the Republican state legislature started taking very vicious measures to try to disenfranchise African Americans. The Fourth Circuit said with almost surgical precision, they looked to see what are the kinds of IDs that African Americans use, and they banned those IDs from being acceptable. What are the places and the ways in which African Americans register to vote, and they banned those kinds of ways of registering to vote. And that's really happening in many places all over the country. And more recently, the court, not only in terms of these measures, but in terms of gerrymandering, the court, again, a decision by Chief Justice Roberts, who everyone thinks is some sort of moderate, basically said, if the states are gerrymandering in such a way as to lock up a permanent majority for one party, even if more people are voting for the other party, that's okay. We're federal courts. We don't have anything to do with that. So really what has happened, what we're seeing now is an effort, very much successful, of the Republican Party to institute a form of minority rule. And that is, there are aspects of the constitutional order that have a tendency to emphasize that anyway. And they are supercharging it and putting it on steroids. And we are going to be entering over the next 10 years an era of growing minority rule driven by the Republican Party.
Well, and given the current makeup of the Supreme Court, I would think that that's not expected to be receding. That's a trend that
they'll do even more. They'll do even more with that. I mean, that's what we have to understand, that we're not really a democracy. We were a democracy maybe for about 35, 40 years. And now they are dragging us back into a period of minority rule.
So analogous to that, I just want to say quickly, I was on a webinar not long ago with some young people over at UC Berkeley, and their question was, why does voter suppression matter? And I said, largely because it impacts communities that have historically been unrepresented in government.
Absolutely.
And it's almost a guarantee that going forward, they will continue to be unrepresented in government. And we're at a point in American history when we, I think, have realized that we need to have these people represented. Otherwise, it's going to spill over in some other way.
Everyone needs to be represented. I mean, all you need is a fair, just give us a level playing field.
Some of us feel that way. Not everybody in this country, 70 million people, probably would disagree with you.
Well, I think a lot of people who are more conservative actually question the democratic basis of the country. They don't think that it is a democracy. Mike Lee, senator from Utah, just a few weeks ago said, look, we're not a democracy and we shouldn't pretend that we are. And that's not the goal.
That's not the goal.
And he was very clear about this. That is not the goal. And he's not some nutcase in a comment section. He's a United States senator. His father was Reagan's Solicitor General. His brother is a justice of the United States Supreme Court. He's royalty in Utah. And I think David Frum, who's one of my favorite commentators, a conservative commentator, said, look, and he didn't like this, he said, look, if conservatives have to choose between democracy and conservatism, they'll choose conservatism. And that's what's happening. We just saw this yesterday. And they backtracked on it, but that in Wayne County, in Michigan, which is where Detroit is, the two members of the canvassing board, which is a sort of a ministerial job to say, okay, these were the votes, let's add them up, let's send them to the state capitol so we can get a final tally, refused to certify the votes out of Wayne County in an effort to stop Michigan's electoral votes from going to Joe Biden. I mean, it was very straightforward that if they could muck this up, then they argued the gerrymandered legislature would be able to choose the electoral votes. And it got even worse than that. The woman who was the chair of the canvassing board, the Republican chair, said, oh, I'd be happy to canvass all the votes in Wayne County, except for the city of Detroit, which just so happens to be about 85% African-American. At this point, Ben Wittes, who's a scholar at Brookings and the Heritage Foundation, said on Twitter this morning, he said, the Republican position is that votes from African-Americans are presumptively illegal. That's their view. And we shouldn't overlook that. That's their view now. You can oppose it or you can support it, but that is what the view is.
I may be wrong, but I think I read that there was a backlash against those guys. They reversed course.
They backed off. That's right. They backed off. It's the
basis. They tried.
They tried and they will try again. And when it's right out in front, that's one thing. But, we'll see more and more of this. This is going to be a very ugly decade.
Well, and we all saw what happened to the security guy who was in charge of deciding whether our elections are fair or not, who said there was no evidence of fraud, and he got fired.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I think to your point, Jonathan, there's going to be a reach for more and more power. And when it's out front and everybody can see it and identify it, there might be some pushback. And so the effort will recede. But I think that there are plenty of ways. And I think one of your articles was talking about this. There are plenty of ways where, power can be grabbed away from everybody's line of sight. That will slowly begin to change. You and I were talking about this, what does America look like a generation from now?
If we continue to keep going in this direction, part of it is based on the system, right? When you have a body like the United States Senate, which is, anti-majoritarian and anti-democratic, it's bad enough. Now that we also have demographic changes, it's getting worse. So, for example, California has about 40 million people and we have two U.S. senators. Wyoming has 500,000 people and it has two U.S. senators. And that's getting greater and greater. I think it was in 1790, the biggest state was about 10 times bigger than the smallest state. Now it's about, 70 times bigger than the smallest state. And so the Senate is rewarding big, thinly populated rural areas. Now, even if the Democrats win the two seats in Georgia that are up in the runoff in about a month, they will represent Democrats with 50 votes in the Senate will represent about 20 million, will represent about 40 million more people than the Republicans do. But even if they lose, if the Republicans get 52 seats and the Democrats have 48, Democrats will still in the Senate represent 20 million more people than the Republicans will. They lose those seats in Georgia. So we're now seeing more and more decisions being taken by less and less Democratic bodies. I grew up thinking, oh, of course the United States is a democracy. No, it's not. We were able to fake it for a while, but with the demographic changes and with the changes in the ideology of the Republican Party, which is explicitly anti-democratic with a small d, that's where we are.
Right, that's where we're heading. That's interesting, though, because that means that the population centers, the cities, are largely to the left of center.
Well, yeah, I think that's right. They are. I mean, virtually every city tends to be bluer. You know, of all the, for example, the mayors, and that's been true for a while. We're now seeing both the cities and the inner ring suburbs, the metropolitan areas. The writer who writes about this so effectively is Ronald Brownstein for The Atlantic, who has just been brilliant on this. He's an LA guy, I think. And talking about sort of the metropolitan areas are strongly Democratic. It's the far suburbs, the exurbs, and the rural areas that are Republican. And that the metropolitan areas outweigh the rural areas in terms of population, but the system produces Republican majorities.
Right. So even though they outweigh by numbers, they don't outweigh by voice. Yeah. So I'm going to bring you to local politics for a second.
Always happy to do that.
Because even here, and I do want to take you to housing, and then I'm going to take you across the globe, but hang on. So
okay. You can take me anywhere, Mariam. You just let me know.
And to rabbinic studies.
Yeah.
We got a lot to cover.
We shall end there. Okay, but just quickly, here locally, just in local politics, there has been talk of changing representation, right? So there's been talk of the fact that LA used to be so much smaller from the city level to the county level, and then California at the state level just had fewer population when we set up sort of representation the way that it is now. And so why don't we increase the numbers of elected representatives that we have out there right now, even locally? So there's been talk about the fact that city council has 15 council districts, but if you were to look at those council districts, most of
them are huge.
Yeah,
they're bigger than a lot of cities.
And very disparate, right? I mean, you know, from one end to the other, it might be totally different people, different populations, different demographics, different interests, and it's tough to represent one district effectively.
Right, and it also makes retail politics difficult.
Very
because
difficult.
Because it's so big that you
can't please anybody.
You can't please anybody. You can't talk to anybody because it's just simply too big.
Right.
The only thing I can tell you with this is what my experience was when I was in the mid-90s, I was a staffer for the elected Charter Reform Commission, for people who remember Mayor Reardon's effort to change the Los Angeles City Charter, et cetera, et cetera. And we talked for a while. I was just a staffer. I wasn't making decisions. But we talked about, well, you know, maybe one of the things we should do is increase the size of the city council. You know, to have 15 people on a city council of a size this big is silly. Incredibly unpopular. Because what it kept getting spun as you just want the city to be spending more money so there can be more politicians. And so it was not a popular measure. In the same way, a lot of things, you know, don't work very well. For example, because it could be spun that way. Another example, just even more than the city, or as much for the city, Los Angeles Unified School District. You've got only 7 members of the school district. The school district is a little bigger than the city, and they're not even full time.
Yeah,
they have another
true.
Job.
Totally. Yeah, that's a different
ahead,
conversation.
It's your show.
No, I want to hear you talk. But yeah, 600,000 families represented by the LAUSD school board. That's another conversation for another day. But they're kind of rethinking their structure too, and they're trying to localize control. But I just want to bring you back to the city for a second.
Okay.
Do you think that the same conversation would happen today? Because I feel like people in districts now realize that they're so different. They can't possibly have, and you know, this can take us into housing, the housing conversation, you know, NIMBYs versus other, you know, very few districts will have like-minded people from one end to the other. And does that hamper some pretty good policies in places where they could be implemented, but they aren't?
Possibly. I don't know. You know, it's interesting. The city has obviously moved leftward significantly in the last 25 years. Whether that would be, whether if you tried to expand the city council now, say from 15 to 25 members of the council, whether that would have any traction. If they tried to put it in the city charter, I don't know.
It would also be a huge outpouring of money because councilmen, besides their salaries, their staff, their offices, and all that stuff.
Absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
At a time when the city is struggling financially, it's
Very, very hard. I mean, if anything, we're going to be having lots of layoffs over the next couple of years.
In the immediate
COVID.
Term, yeah. But I mean, yeah. A little longer.
I mean, it's possible. It's possible that one could say, well, let's expand the size of the city council. We'll have more local control. The, you know, with all of this stuff, it's about whether people would get it. Another big difference, I think, is that there was a major change in the city charter a couple of years ago. At least I thought it was a pretty major change, is that city elections are now going to be coterminous with state elections. And I think that could change the balance, because it used to be city elections were in odd numbered years in April, and you would get like a 15 to 20% turnout that had a tendency to be an older, whiter, and wealthier electorate. Now it's possible that if you do it coterminous with, say, a gubernatorial election, it might change very much. I don't know. I don't know what the answer would be. I realize that, you know, as a professional talker, I'm supposed to have an opinion without knowing anything about the data. But
I'll let you off the hook on that one. So one of the you've written a lot of stuff, books, articles everywhere. One of the things that you talk a lot about is housing.
Okay.
And yeah. Homelessness and affordable housing. And what are your thoughts about what can be done here in Los Angeles, focusing just on our city, not the world?
Yeah. In other words, it would be great if we had the fiscal capacity to spend, you know, $10 billion on affordable housing. We can't. I think we're going to need to allow for more building, but do it in the right kind of way. Our zoned capacity still runs pretty far below what the demand for housing is going to be. That's particularly true with the multifamily market, and particularly true with rental units. I think that whenever anybody hears, you know, affordable housing, or they hear rental units, or they hear multifamily housing — we were talking about this the other day — they have visions of these massive hulking high story towers,
housing projects.
Housing projects. And nobody's the example is one called the Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago, which was notorious for being the worst kind of high rise affordable housing tower. People get afraid of that. But the thing is that nobody's built things like that since the 1950s. So one of the things we can do is we can try to expand. To have what's called the mid-market housing. So one experiment that they've done that they're starting in Minneapolis and in Oregon is allowing in single-family neighborhoods to have a homeowner turn their single-family unit into a duplex or a triplex. So that would begin to allow more units to come online, but not be completely out of scale with a neighborhood. It's not as if you're building a huge apartment building, but if in my neighborhood, my next door neighbor didn't have a single family house, but had a duplex or a triplex, I don't know, I would have a hard time thinking, oh my God, there goes the neighborhood. That would just be, okay, a change in the house. And what that would do is that would begin to expand the capacity of a city without changing the urban form very much. Now, you know, this would have to be a long process of organizing, because it's still difficult when the state changed the rules allowing for what are called accessory dwelling units, granny flats, as I like to call them. That was the original Australian term. I still know a lot of people in single family neighborhoods, or what used to be single family neighborhoods, who are outraged by this. They think having a granny flat in their neighborhood would be the worst possible thing. And I think I don't want to deny that there's a racial or class valence to that. But what you really need to do is you really need to be talking to people and organizing well so that you can start that. There was a bill in the legislature to allow this. It nearly passed. And then it was blocked by, as far as I can tell, it was blocked by labor unions who wanted to mandate certain kinds of apprenticeship categories to work on these projects, which was a damn shame. But I think that that's going to be one to allow duplexes and triplexes in single family neighborhoods. That'll be important. We're going to have to figure out a way to build more. If at the end of the day, you can bend the market, but you can't break it. At one point or another, you can't continue to reduce supply while demand increases and expect that prices will go down. Doesn't make any sense. Here's another example that I think would be really good in Los Angeles that I would love to see. That they call it is YGBI, as opposed to NIMBY, which is not in my backyard, or the YIMBY movement, which is the yes in my backyard. I think something that people are talking about, particularly in San Diego, is YGBI, which is Yes in God's Backyard, which is to allow, as a matter of right, churches and synagogues and other religious institutions to use their facilities to build affordable housing on their sites. They don't have to get a special zoning. They don't have to get a zone change for it. It's allowed by right, so you don't have as many CEQA issues in front of that. And so to allow religious institutions, many of which are believers that this is part of what God is telling them to do, to provide housing for people.
That's interesting, but those locations of faith are located in somebody's backyard, and I'm afraid you'd still have the YGBIs.
You're going to have somebody. You're going to have somebody, but you know, at some point or another, it's got to be, this is life in the big city.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say yes in your backyard, the YGBIs.
I also heard about DIMBY, which is developers in my backyard. So there are all kinds of my personal favorite of all of these acronyms is BANANA, which stands for Build Absolutely Nothing Anywhere Near Anybody.
Excellent, which is what we have now.
Right.
So I want you to talk about. So I know you're a policy guy, and as you say, you get paid to think and talk about it. There's homelessness and the fact that we talk about building for people who are chronically homeless and need a lot of help, like wraparound services. And then there are all of those people for whom housing increasingly inches out of reach and they need a place to live. A lot of them are families. Sometimes these families are headed by single parents. You know, these are not pretty stories. These are usually people for whom, if we knew them and if we knew their stories, we would have empathy for them. These are people who work, so they haven't been homeless long enough to have some, mental impact set in, but they get no help. And so they're constantly facing down homelessness. I'm sure that stress and that trauma impacts their lives and their well-being.
And their kids as well, obviously.
Exactly. And their kids. I mean, there's got to be something that we can do between nothing and everything. And I feel like this swath of people who are constantly, facing the threat of being on the street are among the people that we must be able to do something for at a cost that's a little bit less than, building the ultimate.
Well, I would hope that we could be building, and we spoke about this the other day, hoping that we could be building units, what are called in the HUD characteristics, moderate income housing, which are families earning between 80 and 120% of the median. So for example, a family of four, the median in this metropolitan region is about $55,000 a year. Now that's not a lot of money, but it's not, it's not desperate poverty. These are people who are working, secretaries, sometimes teachers, customer service agents, delivery people, other sort of service workers who, when we talk about, low income housing, you have this vision again of horrible social dislocation. That's not really the case. It's just people who need housing that they can afford. I don't want to demonize people who are on public assistance, but these, for many cases, are not people who are on public assistance, at least as their primary source of income. They may be getting stamps because the wages are so low. In those cases, I think that in a lot of places, we could be building units that are deed restricted for people that are affordable for moderate income families. And maybe folks in the neighborhood who would be worried about that might say, oh, wait a minute, wait, there's secretaries and teachers and police officers living there? Okay, yeah, why, whatever.
But that does not address homelessness. That addresses
It might be addressing
lower
certain
income people.
It addresses the rise in homelessness, though, because it prevents the increased numbers of homeless people.
It depends. I think that there are a lot of different homeless populations. I actually know more about the housing and the land use side than the actual homelessness side in terms of homelessness services. If you're talking about people who are desperately poor, perhaps mentally ill, perhaps veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, other things, no, it wouldn't be dealing with that. It would be dealing with working families who don't earn a tremendous amount of money, but are working and are relatively stable if they have the appropriate kind of support that they could have.
Right. And this could be a support structure. And I think it would be more palatable to many neighborhoods, you know, even those similar to ours, perhaps.
I would hope so. I think that, you know, part of it really does involve a long running community organizing effort to tell the, you know, all right, let's find the people who are interested in this. Let's give people a kind of comfort level with this. What are the various community organizations that are talking about this? You know, people don't want to have something shoved down their throats. Now, there are going to be some people who, no matter what you propose, are going to be opposing it. But there are going to be a lot of people who are going to say, look, you know, I don't want to, I'm happy to, I want to do the right thing, but I don't want to be a sucker.
Right.
And if you involve enough people in the planning process in the right stages and to do a well thought out community outreach effort, you can attract a lot of support. You're going to have your NIMBYs and the people who hate it no matter what you do. But then what you can do is, you know, to put it bluntly, you can isolate them because it turns out that they're really the minority and they'll be outvoted at the community meeting.
They'll be outvoiced. Yeah.
And that takes a lot of effort.
Yeah.
It would be, you know, the United Way is trying to the United Way's Everybody In campaign is attempting to do that. And that's really what we need to do here in the Palisades. You know, we're not going to turn the Palisades into a bunch of low income housing, obviously not, but we should be able to do our part as a part of a citywide effort.
I like that idea. I'm sure somebody's going to listen to this and reach out to you and say, hey, how about
I certainly
that?
Hope so. Happy to talk to anybody.
So I want to go into something else that a little bit different about
it's
you.
It's your show.
And although you do get paid to speak, you're not getting paid today. You hope you know that.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So you and I have many similarities growing up in the same area a decade apart. And
right.
Both lawyers, Jewish upbringing.
Right.
What is it that made you, after you're already a lawyer, you already have a PhD, decide to become a rabbi? Because I never in my life considered that. What is it that's different about the two of us that made you go that direction?
Well, I don't know about what the difference is between the two of us.
Well, you know, what was it for you then?
You and I would have to have a much longer conversation, which I would be delighted to have.
We will do that.
Jonathan, hang on a second. I just want to say, just so everyone knows, Steve Krohn did think about his second career, and it was leading him down the path of landscaping.
Yes,
so there you
that's
go.
Right.
Well, that is extremely important. Well, I'll tell you the quick story. The quick story, and I was mentioning this to you guys the other day, is that I think, you know, I had always, let me put it this way. I think that the Jewish people is in kind of the long crisis of emancipation. And by that, I mean, you know, before about 1800, you didn't decide, you know, well, should I be Jewish? Why should I be Jewish? What does it mean to be Jewish? You were Jewish. They popped you in a ghetto and you were. And it was only in the 1800s when Jews became emancipated to be part of a broader society. And so then the question was, well, you know, what is Judaism going to mean in that? I'm a lover of Judaism. I think Jewish civilization is one of the great achievements of human spirituality and thought. And I think it should be preserved and I want it to continue. But the old model, which was based on an old European or model or in Middle Eastern countries of people who had legal disabilities, doesn't work anymore. So then the question is, what would it mean to be Jewish in the modern world? Well, for about 150 years, we tried what I call high Episcopal Judaism. We could be more Protestant than the Protestants. It didn't work very well. You know, people began to be sort of turned off by that. And for the last 70 years, we've tried Zionism. And, you know, I am very pessimistic about Zionism's future, just as a matter of practicality. But in any event, it's not going to be applicable to the United States. And so we're going to have to be rethinking what it means to be Jewish in the modern world. And, you know, being a rabbi means being part of that conversation. It's going to have to be something that is based on the tradition. You can't just break away from the tradition. It's going to be very much like we're in a moment like we were 2,000 years ago when the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed. And so we couldn't do animal sacrifices and you couldn't have priests and you couldn't do all of that stuff. And the rabbis had to fundamentally transform what this people was My former Talmud teacher, Rabbi Judith Abrams, may she rest in peace, would write about how when the temple was destroyed 2,000 years ago, the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed 2,000 years ago, it's as if somebody's culture and civilization had a nuclear bomb dropped on it. Everything as part of this religion, everything as part of this culture, everything as part of this civilization is suddenly gone. God's house on earth was destroyed. It was this massive trauma. And that somehow over the next few hundred years, the rabbis, these kinds of itinerant teachers, these sort of proto-beatnik Jews, started thinking about how to reconstruct this religion and this people and this civilization. And they did it in such a way that remained true to the tradition, yet at the same time expanded and extended the tradition in a way that was true to the tradition, yet fundamentally different. If you brought a Jew from 2,500 years ago into Jewish civilization now, they literally wouldn't recognize what you're talking about. But they made it, the rabbis made it stick because it was true to the tradition. And there's a great story about this that in the Talmud that I love, that it has to do with when Moses is on Mount Sinai. Moses on Mount Sinai. And he goes to God, and he basically says, God is takes a Torah scroll, and God is putting like little decorations on the different letters on the Torah scroll. If you've ever seen a Torah scroll with all these little decorations on it. And Moses, meanwhile, is realizing he's got a problem down at the bottom of the mountain because of the golden calf. So he goes to God and says, could you please hurry it up? Why are you taking so long? Why are you doing this? And God says to Moses, look, in about 1,000 years, there's going to be a man named Akiva ben Yosef, Akiva, the son of Joseph, who will be able to deduce hundreds and hundreds of laws from every jot and tittle on every single one of these letters. And Moses can't believe this. And he says, wait, show me this man. And so God says, turn around. And Moses turns around and he finds himself 1,000 years in the future. God literally puts him in a time machine. And Moses goes into Rabbi Akiva's study hall, where Rabbi Akiva is teaching all of this stuff, and Moses has no idea what's going on, right? This is Moses. This is the lawgiver. This is the guy who's on Mount Sinai. He has no idea what's happening. And finally, it comes to this point where the students say to Rabbi Akiva, he's trying to explain some point, and they say, but wait a minute, Rabbi, Master, where'd you get that from? And Akiva says, oh, well, this one was given directly to Moses on Mount Sinai.
Mm.
And Moses laughs, and he understands what's going on here. That the point is that the religion is constantly in this process of evolving and recreating itself based on the tradition, but extending the tradition. And the people who do that, among others, are rabbis. And I want to be part of that. I mean, that's really the easiest answer. I never wanted to have a congregation. I wouldn't be a good congregational rabbi, but I want to be able to help out in any way I can. I'll tell you one more story. And then the way that I think of myself as a rabbi has to do with a great scientist at Harvard University, E.O. Wilson. He's a great scientist. He reads about evolution and biodiversity and all of this stuff. And he started out as an entomologist. He studied insects. In particular, he studied ants. And he was looking at ant colonies. Honestly, this has something to do with being a rabbi. Trust me. trust me on this one. And he's looking at these ant colonies, and he finds in these ant colonies there are all these sterile female ants in an ant colony. And he says to himself, why in the world are there sterile female ants in an ant colony? It doesn't make any sense from an evolutionary perspective. What are they doing there? Well, it was only after several years that he realized that the sterile female ants were the ones in the ant colony who were doing all the work and all the things that needed to be done that nobody else had the time to do. And so that's really one of the ways why I want to be a rabbi. I want to be the sterile female aunt of the Jewish people. There's so much work to be done.
The groundwork, yeah.
There's so much work to be done in so many ways. And so I'm hoping that I can find some way to help out. You know, so far nobody's taken me up on it.
Are you,
so
are you an observant Jew?
Yes. I keep kosher. I don't use technology on the Sabbath, which I is actually good for my mental health as much as anything else. You know, take a day off of social media.
So I'm glad you touched on that, because I do think that what it was that led you to be a rabbi And the fact that today you can say to people, you can tell us that you're a rabbi while you're still teaching law and whatever else at UCLA, I think is interesting. I think it's one of the most interesting parts of the conversation anybody can have with you about being a rabbi, because you're not standing in a room telling people what to do, or like you said, what page to turn to, or, you know, where to find the answers. I find you to be this ultimately thoughtful human being.
Wow.
That can, yeah, that can really make people dig a little deeper as to what they believe and what they're doing here. You know, like those ants.
Right.
And I think it's kind of cool. I think it's very cool that you do this. And just for the record, you got your rabbinic ordination from Aleph. And that'll be a quiz for everyone. People can tell us whether or not they know what Aleph is. But it's the Alliance, for you at least, it's the Alliance for Jewish Renewal. And
yes.
You only got this in January of last year, right?
That's right. January 2019. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So, it's relatively new.
Do you plan to do anything? I know you'll be teaching at UCLA Law School for the foreseeable future. Do you plan to do anything in an organized fashion with your rabbinic ordination?
If somebody wants me to, I mean, I've volunteered at a lot of places. Most of the time so far, I will tell you this, for the most part, people, I say, well, you know what, I can do this, or I can do this, or I can do that, or I can do this, or what do you need me for? And so far, most organizations are looking at me in groups saying, no, we got it, we're okay, thanks.
I think you should reach out to Kamala Harris and her husband.
Well, maybe, you know, that they've, I don't have them on speed dial.
No, shocking.
I don't have them on speed dial. I know that Doug Emhoff, he went to USC Law School, and a couple of dear friends of mine, Melissa Balaban, who's the executive director at ECAR, and Adam Wergelis, they know him from law school, and they say, he's a really nice guy.
Yeah, and I think from what I read, they are, very open-minded, and they look for, new ways to balance Judaism. I think it'd be great if you have a
conversation
with him.
I'd be delighted to. If you can make an introduction, Mariam, that's fine with me, but I am like the least well-connected person in the universe.
He is theoretically your neighbor. They do, it's Brentwood. So.
Jonathan,
oh, okay.
Jonathan,
okay,
well, I happen good. To know, I'm pretty sure about this, that Kamala and her husband are regular listeners to the Palisades podcast. And
well,
so
that's
this
fabulous.
May be your entree into the White House.
I am happy to help in any way possible.
We'll talk to
anybody.
Them.
To Kamala or Mamala, as her stepchildren call her, Mamala.
Oh, don't even go there, because that could be the subject of a whole different podcast.
When she was talking about her Jewish mother-in-law, might have been like the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. She met her Jewish mother-in-law.
Yeah,
so
that was great.
That's great.
So on this same vein, I'm going to take you across the globe.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's hard to go anywhere nowadays, so that's fine. Thank
so
you,
at least
Mariam.
We can have this. Yeah, we can have this virtual tripping across the world.
Can I go with you on this trip?
We wouldn't go without you.
All right.
Okay, so you wrote something that I found very, very interesting, and I want to talk about it. Because, I mean, for a thousand reasons, but one of the reasons that it jumped out at me was because I've been to a refugee camp. And I think that people who are sort of stuck in limbo with nowhere to go, they can't go backwards, they can't go forwards, they don't really have a nation that they can call their own to go back to, and they don't really think that there's going to be a nation ahead of them. I actually have at times likened it to homelessness. And I saw an article that you had in the Jewish Journal saying Israel should open Judaism to refugees.
Yes.
Tough sell. But you are a rabbi. Tell us a little bit about that idea. Read it and I thought it was great.
Here is the argument. Wow, nobody's ever asked me about this piece. So
really?
The argument, this was a problem that was, and is going to continue, is that we're facing these massive movements of peoples around the world. And there are so many people, particularly from Sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, who are trying to get to other places because it's so dangerous. I mean, less so now because of COVID. But if we ever get past this, so huge problems about this. So the question is, to what extent should Israel be taking in refugees? Well, there are problems here. On the one hand, there's a moral obligation to take in desperate refugees who are fleeing political persecution. No question about that. On the other hand, first, Israel is a small country. How many people can it absorb? And it is supposed to be, and I believe it should be, the state of the Jewish people. On the other hand, so if you're accepting, there aren't too many Jewish refugees now. And so, you know, what really is Israel's obligation here? So what I posited in the piece was, you know, all the nations should be thinking about kind of what everybody's relative number is that they should take. But what Israel should be doing is going to places where there are large numbers of refugees and saying, look, if you convert to Judaism, you can become a citizen of Israel. And it's a way of, and it's an attempt to square the circle of one, being welcoming to refugees, but two, trying to be the home of the Jewish people. And the fact that they're, you know, Jews are always worried about our demographics. Simon Rabinovich was a mid-20th century thinker, talked about the Jews as being the ever-dying people. We're always worried about our demographics. Well, what would happen? I mean, I think as a general matter, Judaism should be much more welcoming to people of color. But the idea here would be, all right, we've taken the number that we are supposed to take in the sense that all nations have decided to take a certain number of refugees. But we're also saying, look, if you're a refugee and you're fleeing persecution from where you are, if you convert to Judaism, you can become an Israeli citizen. Now, the obvious objection to this is, yeah, but are they really going to mean it? Is it going to mean anything to them? Are they just going to be doing it for the form? And what I believe is, and this is where it gets more controversial, but I think is true, is that within two or three generations, it literally won't matter. Right? The first generation may not really mean it. The second generation will kind of mean it. The third generation won't even remember where the first generation came from. And so this would be a way that Israel could be opening and welcoming and humanitarian while at the same time reinforcing its Jewish bona fides and dealing with the long-term Jewish demographic problem. You know, there aren't too many of us. My wife, who is not Jewish, said to me, wait a minute, how many Jews are there in the world? And I said, about 13 and a half million. She said, 13 and a half million? I was like, yeah. That's not very many. No, that's not very many. Yeah.
That is 13 not very many at all.
That is not very many. And so she said to me, wait a minute, then how come everybody I know is Jewish? And the answer is because you're somebody in a major urban center in the United States with an advanced degree. But there aren't very many of us. So this is a way to make more Jews and be humanitarian at the same time.
But Rabbi, what about the notion that I was raised with, which is that Jews do not solicit people to become part of Judaism? You really have to work at it. You can't just join. You've got to go through all the initiation, not the initiation, but all the study
and
preparation and all that stuff.
There's some of that, but that can be very much overemphasized. Look, there is a large gap between saying there are a lot of options in there between, on the one hand, no, we don't accept converts, and let's go be Jehovah's Witnesses and start proselytizing and knocking on everybody's door. There's a lot of gaps in between there.
Okay.
Simply to be welcoming and open and making things available is different than proselytizing and knocking on doors.
But making it available with a prize at the end.
Yeah. So,
well,
that's fine.
All right. So,
you know, that doesn't bother me, especially because if you take a look at Jewish history, a lot of Jewish history, there was more the prize at the end was that you wouldn't be killed. In the Maccabees, you know, everybody knows the story of the Maccabees. Hanukkah's coming up in 25 days, 23 days. All of this stuff. The Maccabees forcibly converted the nation of Edom in the first century BCE. The infamous King Herod was an Edomite who was forcibly used. His family was converted to Judaism. By 150 years later, when Jerusalem was under the siege of the Romans, a lot of the fiercest fighters for the Jews were the Edomites, whose ancestors had been forcibly converted. These things change a lot. And the idea that something, you know, I remember I heard this too growing up. Oh, you're supposed to tell somebody three times that they're not allowed to convert to Judaism. That's just wrong. It's just wrong. And I think as things are changing in a society where people move in and out of identities much more quickly and much more strangely than before, we need to rethink how we can be more welcoming. The most fastest growing religious group in the United States is?
What is it?
Okay. It is what is known as the nuns, which is not N-U-N-S, but rather N-O-N-E-S. The nuns, usually young people who describe themselves as spiritual but not religious, who are not atheists and are not agnostic, but are skeptical of organized religion.
I believe it.
That's the fastest growing. There's a wonderful book by Robert Putnam called American Grace. It's based on the Pew study of American religion. Very fast growing group. You don't have to be in the position of proselytizing to say, well, maybe people are looking for something. And I'm really a firm believer. You know, how do you know who is a Jew? Well, one of the ways in which you know who is a Jew is whose soul is touched by Judaism. That doesn't have to be somebody who was born that way. In fact, quite often it isn't somebody who was born that way. It's somebody who, when they see and they experience Judaism, and there's so much good stuff in there, that they say, yes, this is for me. Well, for us to say we're not going to be welcoming to that is not being hospitable, which is and hospitality is a very important Jewish notion.
True.
So you need to be doing that. Sorry, don't want to cut you off.
No, I love it. And like I said, I mean, I read it and I thought, I wonder, I wonder how that was received.
I think it was ignored, like most of the things that I say, but that's fine.
Not after you've been on the Pally exactly. podcast.
Well, yes, after the Pally podcast. This is,
your ship has just come in.
That's right, absolutely.
So speaking of a changing world, Jonathan, what's Hanukkah going to look like in the Palisades this year?
I don't know. I suspect that Chabad is still going to put up their Hanukkah, which would be great.
But the same community coming out and, you know, being
I don't know.
Present.
I mean, I think we could do it if it's outside and it's appropriately socially distanced and everybody's wearing a mask. I think that, in fact, that would be an opportunity for community. So I think that could be an opportunity. You know, we're so fortunate in one sense here in Southern California that you can actually stand outside in the middle of December and not freeze
not
your tuchus
freezing.
Off,
yeah.
as my grandmother would say. But I think that
Hanukkah might endure in the Palisades this year.
I think so. The other thing, of course, always to say about Hanukkah, and I think for a lot of people in the Palisades, this would be attractive, is Hanukkah is really the ultimate environmental holiday. Because the miracle of the light was that the Maccabees, when they came back into the temple, they only had enough oil to last in the temple for one day, but it lasted for 8 days. That's the miracle of Hanukkah.
So it's an environmental kind of holiday?
Yeah, I mean, it was basically the temple, the menorah in the temple was turned into a hybrid with better miles per gallon. That's literally what it was. They only had enough oil for one day, but in fact, they could take a little bit of fossil fuel, or actually it was olive oil, but a little bit of fuel and make it last for a lot longer. More miles per gallon. That's really the theme of Hanukkah. It's really the environmental holiday.
I love it. You have it here first, folks, in Pacific Palisades on the Pally podcast.
Hanukkah
is the environmental holiday.
It is.
We could ask you about your environmental thoughts every day I'm hustling or what to do for Earth Day.
That's right. My involvement with the Environmental Voter Project.
Yeah. So environment, and then it's the Palisades. How can we not touch on environment? And then we'll.
Okay. Well, I spent a lot of time working this last year with the Environmental Voter Project, which is a nonprofit that basically tries to find out and uses big data to identify registered voters who are low propensity voters who don't come out and vote very much, but based on their demographic and other economic profiles, figure to be people who care a lot about the environment and gets them to vote. So the idea is they use in the same way that Target or Costco or any other business would look at what people have purchased and what people do and what are the sites that they use and what are the products and the services they consume and try to come up with a pattern to figure out, okay, is this somebody who would be interested in our product? The Environmental Voter Project uses that same kind of data to try to figure out who are people who would really care about the environment. And once they care about they think these are people who care about the environment, they basically just try to get them to vote. And so I spent a lot of time when I said every day I'm hustling, they use a texting app called Hustle to try to get in touch with people who are voters. I sent tens of thousands of texts for them for the election. And with Environmental Voter Project, we're a nonprofit. We don't tell people who to vote for. We just tell people to vote. And the idea is to get out more first time voters and to turn voting into a habit.
And it was so successful that I believe you've doubled the numbers in 2 years. That's amazing. And that is truly maybe the future of politics and politicking is not so much the identity politics, but policy politics,
well,
values
use of data.
Politics.
Certainly, yeah. The use of data. I mean, I've never spoken to anybody about environmental issues while texting or phone calling for EVP. It's always just been, can you vote?
Right.
Here's how you vote. Here's how to make it easy to vote. Here's one of the other things that I think is very important about Environmental Voter Project is that because it's a nonprofit and because it's not affiliated with a campaign, other nonprofits like synagogues and churches.
Yeah,
there's
get
a
on
new
board.
Environmental organization here in the Palisades called Resilient Palisades, which is involved with environmental issues. I did a training for them with this. If you're a 501c3, if you don't get involved in partisan politics, that doesn't mean you can't be involved in political. It doesn't mean you can't be involved in campaigns and getting out the vote. And the Environmental Voter Project is one of the best ways to do it.
I love it. Indirectly impacting the things you care about.
Jonathan,
exactly. It has truly been a pleasure talking to you today. That was really fun. It was like around the world in 80 minutes.
Exactly.
Virtually.
Exactly.
Thanks, Jonathan. It was great having
you. Thanks, guys.